Every facet of the real estate business presents an opportunity to tell a story. Think about pitch meetings for development and investing, brokerage and sales efforts, leading operations and talent, you name it. The skill of storytelling is an essential tool for communicating, building successful relationships, and, these days, sustaining a sense of vital humanity in businesses where the use of AI is growing. On this episode, a noted leadership expert and author returns to share more about these ideas and to expand on her new book with a focus on the concept of persuasion.
What I want to try to get people to think about is where do they direct their attention? Because where you direct your attention is where the rest of your resources, your energy, and everything else goes to.
That's Esther Choi, CEO of the Leadership Story Lab, a boutique executive coaching company, and the author of a new book called Winning Without Persuading. It's a follow-up to her first book about business communication, Let the Story Do the Work. Esther's portfolio is dedicated to training executives on how to use storytelling in any line of work. Coming up, Esther Choi with new ideas about crafting and cultivating stories, an undervalued yet increasingly vital business skill. I'm Spencer Levy, and that's right now on The Weekly Take. Welcome to The Weekly Take, and we are delighted to have Esther Choi. Esther, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Delighted to have you. Just love your book. Tell me about the new book. What's different about it than the old book?
There are lots and lots and lots of books nowadays about the importance as well as the how-to of telling great stories. And I think there's a really big hole in the collections. And that is, while it's important to tell your story, it's just as important to get other people to tell you their story. And so that's the impetus of me working on a second book. And I call it Winning Without Persuading, to take the inspiration from a book that many listeners might have heard of, and that is called The Art of War by Sun Tzu. And a phrase that is quite well known from the book is something called winning without fighting. So the highest form of winning is to win without even having to fight. And so my inspiration from that is that it's important to win. We want to win. And there is a huge, huge missed opportunity of winning without persuading.
Mm-hmm. And to use another Sun Tzu quote, every battle is won before it is fought. And there is a tremendous amount of truth there, certainly in the pitch context, where so much goes into it far beyond just the substance of what you're trying to sell.
Can't agree with more.
When you wrote this title, Winning Without Persuading, it struck me as unusual, because we're in the real estate business. Many of our colleagues are in the brokerage side, and winning is the most important thing.
On the surface, it might seem like I'm contradicting myself, because I help executives become more persuasive. That is still something that is shared by most people, that the only way to win is to be persuasive. And I am trying to say through my second book that you can win without the only way to win to be persuasive. Winning is still important, but we don't have to win only through persuading.
The way I took this book versus your last book, and again, this is my take on it, was that your last book was more tactical, meaning that you're winning in the moment. This book is more strategic. You're winning by having better relationships. That was my summary takeaway. Did I simplify it too much?
I think relationships and trust is at the cornerstone of every win. And I think in that sense, that is a very fair summary. What I want to try to get people to think about is where do they direct their attention? Because where you direct your attention is where the rest of your resources, your energy, and everything else goes to. And where I'm trying to direct attention, people's attention is not only on themselves. What is my story? What do I have to say? What winning strategies do I have to offer? And instead, direct it to their clients, through their teams, and sometimes even to their adversaries. Because when you direct your attentions at them and worry less about what is the perfect thing to say in the perfect moment, you can surprise yourself and everyone else by other possibilities and ideas and ways to win. Mm-hmm. So that's what the book is about.
You use a line here very early in your book, use listening not as a courtesy, but as a creative act. What does that mean?
When you think of listening as an obligation, that's what well-trained, well-mannered, polite people do. We take our turns, and it's not our turn to speak, then we listen. But when you think of listening as a creative act, then not only does it take the obligation, the must-do out of it, and listening is a way to discover stories that oftentimes your audience don't even know that they need to tell, and maybe sometimes even don't have words for it. But when you're the one who is responsible for discovering it, then you and your audience win. What I'm also encouraging people to think about is that when you are present, then you can notice things that most people just not even registered. And when you notice things that most people don't register, then you can have the doorway open to you that other people don't even see is there.
Then you talk about the power of curiosity. What does that mean?
The power of curiosity isn't just about satisfying a need to know, or in some cases, being nosy. I think the power of curiosity is suspending what you believe to be true and explore whether there are other possibilities, even at times when it might make you uncomfortable.
So I'm glad you used that word, uncomfortable. There's a quote here from the book, "Workplace norms complicate things." There's a wall that's created by the workplace. Mm-hmm. How does being in a modern workplace complicate your lessons about being a good storyteller and a good story listener?
Well, I am speaking mostly from my live experience in the U.S., and that is we want to be inclusive and sensitive to other people, where in a generation or two ago, what is appropriate to say or ask is no longer in present day. And so a lot of people feel like maybe walking on eggshells, because you don't know where sometimes the boundary changes on you. However, even knowing that, I think there are some ways, very effective ways, to be curious. Number one, being present, meaning that you're not trying to multitask. It's fairly obvious when we are multitasking. And so that intention of being curious is already taken. And then the second thing is, when you are listening, do you listen to find the moment to say what you want to say, or do you listen to discovered?
You hear so often that data is the new oil. You hear so much about data being the most important thing. And I'm reading right here in your book about the ladder of inference, about how data really is important, how it isn't important, but it's just a tool to get you to the point of storytelling. Tell us how you get from data to storytelling about data.
The ladder of inference is trying to peel back the onion of why people hold certain opinions, why they show up at work a certain way, why they have certain perspective, why they believe in a certain thing. Whether you're in a deal, whether you are working with someone closely or whether you're just getting to know someone, all we can observe is the surface level stuff. And so if we understand data is just the source of the beginning of the shaping of behavior, beliefs, point of views, interactions, then it gives us that room to be curious. I love this phrase from my colleague and friend, consumer anthropologist Gina Fong. She said, "People may not make sense to you, but they always make sense to themselves." And so every day, whether it's at work or at home, it's to everybody's benefit to be curious, to get to where did the data start from you, to get to why you are, why you say, why you believe the way you do.
So let's go back to our audience here for just a moment. We have many audience members that are brokers or aspiring brokers. We have many that are institutional investors. And there was a section here in the book of how you were coaching an institutional investor of how to present at a meeting to get new capital for their fund. And the quote here is, his first instinct was to default to the familiar, performance, people, process. But then the winning formula for this individual in your book was, he told a story about his grandmother. Tell us about that.
As large institutions, you do have to have process and standards, and they are very successful. So they use that formula. So why shouldn't they default to it? In that case, because the mandate has something to do with establishing a first Social Security fund for its aging population, and that client happened to have grown up in Germany, where even today is regarded as one of the golden standard of Social Security. And so he told a story of his hardworking, divorced single parent grandmother who used to run a corner drugstores, but got driven out of competition when the big box arrived. She couldn't even buy her products at the price level that these big boxes are selling. So she had to close her business, but because she had pay in, the great Social Security system of Germany kicked in and took care of her and helped her maintain her livelihood and her dignity. My client was a youngster at the time, and that left a strong impression on him. And now, standing in front of these group of people who make the final decisions against seven other competitors who all look very, very accomplished and competent, but they all look the same to the decision makers. But this story stood out to them. He could tell their body language literally changed and softened, because to him, here's a chance for him to help create a system that help retirees maintain a safety net and dignity that was afforded to his grandmother.
And it was a personal story, and it resonated, and it was the winner, not the formulaic approach that they might have otherwise taken. And there's so many lessons here about communication and leadership. You mentioned an interesting one in honor of the wedding of Travis Kelce and Taylor Swift. You had some lessons learned from Taylor Swift. What were they?
Yes. That was in a section of why so many people are reluctant to tell their stories. It's not because they don't know it. It's not because they are not proud of it. But in many, many cultures, this is where the phrase top poppy syndromes comes in. You can become an easy target. And so when Taylor was so successful, even many years ago, there were a lot of people who did not wish her well and who was trying to cut her down. And I brought her story up in the context of, you know, there's only one Taylor Swift in the world, or maybe ever. And despite the pervasive tall poppy syndrome, she survived it and she thrived and she became the global megastar that she is. But it's not easy. And most people would go a great length to avoid being cut down by staying small, by not telling their stories.
In that very same section, you quote legal scholar Kenji Yoshino, who calls it, quote, covering, that's the term, and in the definition is the act of softening or downplaying your identity so you can blend in, not to deceive, but to belong. And again, this comes right back to the culture in which you are working. How do you, to quote Frank Sinatra, toot your horn in the appropriate way?
So that section I wrote not only for readers for themselves, but also as leaders who might have people on their team whom they suspect have important things to say, but they won't say it, or it takes a lot to pry out of them or to nudge them. And I think to your point, people come to work showing up with many prior experiences that we cannot undo. As much as we want people to toot their own horns, there are a lot of forces working against them. So my philosophy is don't work against it, work with it. These cultural, personal, professional, psychological forces that work against tooting your own horns, don't work against it, work with it. For example, if you're brought up in a culture where talking positively about yourself, sharing simply about your accomplishment feels like bragging, that's a real psychological hurdle. And so this is where that phrase that I truly believe in is that sometimes the best way to get someone's attention is by giving them yours. So if you're someone who is uncomfortable bragging, tooting your own horn, why not share that attention? Why not get other people to tell you their accomplishment, their struggles, their challenges? Because you know what? The beautiful thing is that it's human to reciprocate. So oftentimes when you bring attention to someone else, the attention bounces back to you.
I think nudge people to speak up more. That's the job of a leader. The job of a leader is to nudge people to be the best themselves they can be. And sometimes you got to push them a little bit. You don't shove them, you nudge them. The point is that leaders make everybody around them better by finding their voice. Is that a good way to put it?
Yeah. Can I bring up the three level of speaking up?
Absolutely.
Usually people who don't speak up, they know the detrimental consequences of them perpetually not speaking up.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not about knowing. It's against there are many obstacles that have worked against it. So think of it as a ladder. If you want to climb up to the top of the ladder, you don't leap, you don't jump, not only because it's a big expensive energy, but oftentimes it's impossible. So you start with the first rung. And so the first rung of speaking up is, why not just ask clarifying questions or summarize? Because people think things are clear when 99% of the time it's not. So it's the least risky, but the most rewarding. Once you get comfortable with it, the second level is add and subtract. This is riskier, but also similar reward in that oftentimes something is missing that needed addition, and vice versa, when we're trying to accomplish too much or there are too many priorities, everything is important, nothing becomes important. So speak up to subtract something. And then the last level is challenge and change. You're directly challenging someone or something that is risky. That's why it's the top rung. But once you get used to hearing your own voice making a positive difference, that positive reinforcement, self-reinforcing mechanism will enable the person to speak up more, taking on a little bit more risk at the time.
So there's a selfish element to this. Being a leader, if you want to learn more and use some of this for yourself, pay attention, be a facilitator and not a teacher. And the difference between being a teacher and a facilitator, as you put it, is if teaching is driving the bus, facilitation is directing traffic. If presenting is a solo performance, Facilitation is jazz, improvisational, co-created, responsive to the beat of the group. Sounds unstructured, sounds unbusinesslike. How do we persuade people to do that?
If you have moments in your career where you don't have the answers, you couldn't possibly be the only one who have the answers, and the best answers lies in pieces that your teams as well as your clients hold, then that jazz analogy of playing it together, listening to one another, getting the best out of each other, being facilitative instead of directive, is the way to figure out the best answers available, so that this is not a burden that is solely rest on your shoulders alone.
This book and your prior book is about storytelling. It's about persuading, but it brings up the power of silence. I tell, in the very first moments of teaching people public speaking, I tell them silence is your single most impactful tool of persuasion. And it's right here in your book, Silence Communicates. Tell us about that, Esther.
Words, messages, visuals, everything moves at a speed that is hard for us to truly process. You might have heard everything, but you didn't get everything. You couldn't possibly. So silence, or I'd call it strategic pauses.
I call it the pause.
The pause.
But strategic pauses, same definition.
It's almost like if you have a very important text, but it's so dense, there's hardly any white space. It's really hard to process visually for your eyes. So for our ears, it's the same thing. If we don't have silence, then we don't have the white space to truly process. And that's why we might have heard everything, but didn't get everything. Far from it. And so having pause, or strategic pauses, create that breathing room for people to truly get it. Give them a chance. And secondly, this is also where you put emphasis, because we can agree that if everything is important, then nothing is. So having that silence create the audio hierarchy of importance. And to those who are maybe a little reluctant to share, to speak up, when there's silence and you know it's their turn, they will speak up if there's silence. But if we constantly fill in the silence ourselves, then they don't have to.
I remember the movie about Mr. Rogers starring Tom Hanks. And there's a scene in the movie where Tom Hanks addresses the camera and says, just let's be silent for 1 minute. And a minute's a long time. But I remember how powerful that was. And it reinforced to me the power of silence, the power of reflection. And that reflection can happen in a few moments. It could happen in a minute.
And it's done so rarely that if you do it, you are handing out gold.
I have some dear friends all over this industry, and I hope I don't embarrass her by naming her. She's been a guest on the show, Barbara Perrier, one of the very best industrial professionals in the world. So Barbara and I had a difference of opinion. And the difference of opinion that we had was, when you're pitching something, let's assume you're pitching to sell an asset, do you put the value of the asset at the end of the pitch? Do you put the value of your services at the end of the pitch? Or do you do what I advocate, which is upfront? You tell them the day before. And then I read your book and you talked about the power of suspense. So This is a shout out to you, Barbara. I think Esther is more in your camp than in mine on the power of suspense when you're pitching. Your book advocates for suspense. Mm-hmm. And maybe there is some value to not leading the audience along, but waiting to the end. But she felt that if you told them up front, it would make some of them tune out.
If you would, for a moment, picture this with me, a seesaw on a playground. On the one end, we have curiosity. On the other end, we have clarity. If your goal is to keep the seesaw going, the momentum going, or in this case, I use this as an analogy for what keeps a story going, is the toggling between inspiring, arousing curiosity, and providing clarity. So I think your stand and Barbara's stands, I think they're both valid, but you have to think about if you have too much suspense, you can lose people. You can create unproductive frustrations. But if, on the other hand, you have too much clarity, you're signaling they don't need to pay attention. It's the toggling between the two that keeps story going.
Well, it's the storytelling that matters. And to go from one end of the spectrum to the other, I often use the example of the children's show Scooby-Doo, which I know is both of our favorites here. And Scooby-Doo had the same plot in every episode. It was always some real estate person building condos in the amusement park so they could dress up in a ghost costume to scare people away so he can build. Mm-hmm. But you watch every Scooby-Doo episode anyways, even though you knew how the story was going to end, that it was those rotten kids pulling the ghost costume off this guy. But the bottom line was you listened because of the storytelling, even if you knew the ending.
Well, we have seen some of the best blockbusters, movies, and award-winning films like Apollo 13 and Lincoln. It's not because we don't know what happened to Apollo 13, right? We knew what happened to the Civil War, but we still love that story. We still love listening to that story. And sometimes people watch the same movies over and over again. And this is not like the same show, but different episodes. This is the same movies, but they still watch it. It's because when the suspense is there, even though you know what comes around, it's a delight. It's like we appreciate beauty. We appreciate good food. We appreciate friendship and great conversation. We appreciate suspense. I'm not a neurologist or humanist, so I can't explain why, but I just know that we do.
But let me tell you a story. I couldn't go this whole episode without using that phrase.
Time flies.
So one of the best speakers I ever hired for an event was Ben Stein, who was better known to our listening audience as the guy who was Bueller in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Mm-hmm. Also had a TV show, Win Ben Stein's Money. He also was an economist for Richard Nixon. So this guy had some creds beyond just being a funny guy with his unusual personality. But the reason why he was the best speaker I ever hired for an event was because he worked the room. And this is, comes directly out of your last chapter here. He didn't just give a speech. He went to the dinner the night before. Mm. He went to the breakfast the day of. And he learned about the audience. He learned their names. He learned where they were from. He learned their backgrounds. And then he used some of it on stage. He owned that audience before he got to the stage. And you talk about priming the room, working the room, knowing that audience, owning that audience, maybe that's too strong a way of putting it, is the nature of winning. Tell us about that.
I'd actually like the phrase owning the room. If I could add one more word, it's like owning the dynamic of the room. Mm-hmm. You know, there are not things for people for you to own, but the dynamic of the relationship, just even for an hour maybe of them listening to you as a keynote speaker, you own that piece. And I'm not surprised that Ben went to dinner, went to breakfast, got to know people, worked the room, learned people's names, because that creates relationship, that creates context. And those things in capable hands like Ben's, like you, like a lot of great speakers, then are used as glue to things that you want to make sticky. Not just wishing they're sticky, but you actually create the glue for your story and your message to stick.
You have a device which you call, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ella AI, mm-hmm. which helps people. Tell us about what Ella AI is and how it helps people communicate.
Well, I think we've all seen if you use LinkedIn even a little bit and you notice a lot of posts are very clearly written by AI. Because there are certain words and cadence and phrasing. I don't know about you. It's a turnoff because
you do know about me and you know I'm totally against that. So you knew me well enough to know that I'm right with you.
Because the assumption is if you use a machine to do this for you, why do I need to listen? And that maybe is too harsh, but I'm trying to capture what a lot of people feel. And so what Ella, when we invested in creating it, and we work with a development company to do it, is using my 15, 16 years of body of knowledge, building on top of the capability of AI, LLM, to help users find their stories. Now, it can write your stories. I don't advertise that. I don't encourage that. Because using my content only then makes it feel like I'm in the room with you, guiding you, nudging you, coaching you. And it's in that reflective process that makes your story truly you and not something that some machines created for you.
And I think that the most important thing you have is your voice. And your voice is you. You and you alone. And AI smells like AI.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying AI is bad. I use AI. I use AI for ideas and for organizing my thoughts and things like that. But never, ever to substitute for my own voice.
I would caution everyone, myself included, because I fell down that slope very rapidly myself, is that it's so fast that it's so tempting to use just a little bit more, just a little bit more, just a little bit more until you don't have your voice anymore. But what it turned out sounds good, but not you.
Mm-hmm.
And so that expediency of AI and what you're trading in, what you're giving away, your voice, I couldn't agree with more. It's really hard to get back. It's just like, well, my data, my personal data, but trading it with convenience or my attention, well, giving my attention away to some apps and some social medias, and then one thing lead to another, you're giving more and more of it before you even know it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the same kind of danger, caution I share with you, is that your voice, we have to be very vigilant, guarding and nurturing and growing instead of outsourcing.
The bottom line is you have to keep your ability to have your individual voice, because then, ba-dum-bump, you'll be heard.
Yeah, it's the, I think, the dynamic of not either or, but yes and.
Mm-hmm.
We need AI. That ship has sailed. There's no turning back. We need corporate expectations, but it's not either or, it's yes and.
What are your final thoughts for a commercial real estate audience listening to Esther Choi talk about her terrific new book, Winning Without Persuading?
I would say the harder you try to grab on, hold on to something, the faster you lose it. So the more desperate you are of winning a deal, the more you want to come across as credible and confident and convincing. Sometimes it can backfire. The more you want to win, the more you want to persuade. By persuading, the less likely you're going to win. And so my best piece of advice is that let other people have your attention, and chances are very high that they would want your attention in return.
In short, voice is a two-way street. Maintain your voice, but make sure you are not just listening, hearing somebody else's voice, but absorbing it, getting it. Listening is the key from being a great storyteller to being a great leader.
100%. I couldn't have said it better.
So on behalf of The Weekly Take, what a pleasure to have book author Esther Choi, second time on the show, will certainly not be the last, CEO of the Leadership Story Lab. Most recent book is Winning Without Persuading, which I can't recommend highly enough. Esther, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks to you for tuning in. We'll be back with a big real estate story that's going to be hot off the presses next week. Namely, our annual mid-year market outlook, powered by the expertise of CBRE's research team and top economic thought leaders. It'll be available on our usual podcast channels with a full video version on our YouTube page. check it out. In the meantime, you can find more information on our website, cbre.com/theweeklytake, or wherever you listen. Hope you're having a good summer. I'm Spencer Levy. Be smart, be safe, be well.